It's 1:11 a.m. in Holmby Hills, Los Angeles, and you're listening to Night Call. Night Call. And welcome to Night Call, a podcast for your strange days and lonely nights. My name is Emily Yoshida. I am in New York City. And with me, as always, on the other line, I have
Molly Lambert and
Tess Lynch, of course. Hello.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome back to Night Call.
Welcome back to Night Call. Another week. Another lonely week.
Another call. Another week, another call. Tess and I, at least, had our journey to Rhyme City this past weekend, the weekend that Detective Pikachu came out, and blew Avengers out of the water.
Boom.
This is now a Boffo Bio podcast. We care about those returns, baby.
The only time I've ever played the stock exchange was when I did the Hollywood stock exchange.
Me too!
That's right. I totally did that.
Yeah. Of course, it cost no money. That's why we did it. Also, I'll bet we were both really good at it, which is why we're all now super producers.
Yep.
Yeah.
Just like Julia Phillips. I will say that Night Call did Night Call the success of Detective Pikachu.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, all aboard.
We can take a tiny bit of credit too for kind of delving into Dan Hernandez, co-writer of Detective Pikachu's history as the son of a cryptozoologist.
Right. Yeah, that was a real origin story.
It was.
People were like, "Oh, I don't know about this Detective Pikachu movie," but they say one of the co-writers had a father who was a cryptozoologist. Well, he's got the stuff. This is my kind of adaptation.
They're like, he might know Pokemons, but does he know about what Hattie told Maddie?
Exactly. Skunk Gate.
Yeah, everybody go listen to our podcast with Dan Hernandez if you have not already. We go in on the Pika Pikas and the Psyducks and whatnot. But Tess, you got to go to the Americana to see Detective Pikachu on opening day, which I feel like must have been a zoo, the central hive of every child who wants to see Detective Pikachu.
Let me tell you a little hack that I did. We knew that it was going to be crazy on Friday at the Americana, but we also knew that children get out of school at 3. Mm-hmm. And so we went on the Fandango. We got the tickets to Detective Pikachu well in advance for the 2:15 showing. We ripped our children out of school early ripped them from their campuses. We stuffed them into the sedan and off we rode to the Americana. And it was great because it was a pretty full house. But then on the way out, we saw a bunch of people come and we were like, ha ha.
Wow, you got it. That is a good hack.
And we're really good at, honestly, the Americana, I now feel like I have all the inside secrets of the Americana. I will tell you this also, is that I learned on Easter, to see the Easter Bunny and get your photo taken with the Easter Bunny is like crazy expensive. But if you just hang out and wait for the bunny's carrot break, the bunny is going to walk to his carrot break and he'll come over and wave to your children. And then you can be like, oh, look at that. He waved it. Oh,
we also did this hack.
Yeah, it's such a good hack.
I think it was maybe the same day. I was there with my brother.
Yeah.
And his wife and their child.
That's how you do it.
We were there the day the bunny was taking his press photos. So they were just doing a bunch of posed photos of the bunny all over the park. But yeah,
the paparazzi were on it.
Get the bunny in the background waving at the kid for free.
Yep. So that's how you do it. And that's how you go see Detective Pikachu, is you go to the 2:15 showing.
Tess, what were your kids' favorite parts of the film? Like what was the bang for their buck?
They loved all of it. I would say that, so my kids are almost 7 and 3.5 years old, and my 3.5-year-old has never seen, I mean, she saw How to Train Your Dragon in the theaters. She saw Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. But this was maybe the most, like, suspenseful.
Well, it's a very like, I was sitting in between like kids because that was just where our seats ended up being. And I was looking over and I was like, are they paying attention? Like, it's a pretty like advanced film. But then I was also like, I don't understand any of the like Mewtwo, like all this deep Pokemon mythology stuff. So I was lost on that. And I'm like, they probably get all that. Like, I can follow the detective story, which is like surprisingly advanced for a children's movie. Yeah,
it was.
And then
yeah,
they can get all the like deep Pokemon mythology stuff, and Yeah.
Well, yes. So my son is like very, very deep, has been into the Pokemon verse for a long time. And my daughter
is Pokemon deep state.
Yes. The Poke deep state. My daughter has kind of like started to learn. So she's really into, like, she was into the Bulbasaurs. There's a big, you know, twist ending. We won't spoil it. But I will say, I don't think I'm spoiling much by saying that even I did not realize that the Pokemon Mewtwo, which looks like it looks like kind of like an interpretive, like a modern dancer in like a full length pink leotard.
The quads are incredible. Like the hams and quads on Mewtwo are like bodybuilder level. I just like. Yeah,
Mewtwo is terrifying. Yeah. Mewtwo floats in a tank because Mewtwo was made in a lab from the remains of ancient Mew, which is maybe extinct.
Like the original Pokemon.
So my son, one of the first cards he asked for was Mew, which I think I may have gotten even a fake one, but I'm not sure.
On eBay, bootleg and Pokemon cards for your kids.
It's a whole thing. Your kid will come home and he's like peeled apart the cards because there's supposed to be like a little black layer between, and then they're like, you have to look at the fonts and the borders and all this stuff to see if they're real, and then you have to be like, does it matter? And they're like, maybe not. But the card for Mew is covered in, like, hieroglyphics.
Right.
Yeah, they tried to clone Mewtwo and ended up, or ancient Mew, and then ended up with
Mewtwo.
But
that's in the film, though.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, they have, like, a little informational video but when they're going into Rhyme City, which is very, very, like, fun, where they kind of explain what Pokemon are in the world. And it shows, like, throughout history, Pokemon and humans have lived side by side. And they have, like, the old ancient Egyptian art with like the Bulbasaur and stuff next to the Pharaoh, and it's like very fun. That kind of stuff I always get a kick out of.
That almost felt like an homage to Zootopia.
You know,
where they're riding that train and being to Zootopia, where we all live harmoniously. But it's a really effective way to like get the feel. I don't know. I thought
very
it was a really well
storytelling
done movie. My kids were super into it.
Yeah. No, yes. I was into it. The degree of cuteness achieved by the animators who animated Pikachu is just like, I feel like it's worth, like, they need to have a cuteness Oscar or something, because I've been thinking a lot about the engineering of cute and like why I feel like I want to peel off my skin when I'm looking at Pikachu, like why it's just like too cute for me to handle. Yeah,
it's his mouth and eyebrows.
Guys,
his mouth and eyebrows are tremendously well animated.
Sorry, I'm going really deep into whether Mewtwo is part of something about Mew, the lost continent.
Is it?
There's no way to know. There's no way.
Probably, I don't know.
It's an ancient lost continent proposed by 19th century traveler and writer Augustus Le Plongeon, who claimed that several ancient civilizations, such as those of Egypt and Mesoamerica, were created by refugees from Mu that sank into the Atlantic Ocean.
Whoa. Okay, well, that's pretty convincing. I did not expect you to.
It has no factual basis. Scientists dismiss Mu and other alleged lost continents like Lemuria as physically impossible. It's just MU. But it says there's also, in the 1983 Doraemon Doraemon Nobita in the Castle of the Undersea Devil, Doraemon and friends meet a young boy from Mu who is an undersea person. They set out into the Bermuda Triangle to stop the army inside it. There's like a bunch of anime, I guess, that talk about the lost continent
of
the moon.
Whoa, Molly, good reporting.
And an H.P. Lovecraft story.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like the Pokemon mythos goes deep. It is like the Lovecraft mythos. It has a lot of like weird imaginary monsters, but they're cute instead of being horrifying.
That's true. Like the Squirtle.
But then Mewtwo is kind of scary.
Yes, Mewtwo is scary. I mean, there are many scary Pokemon, and that's the whole deal.
And they're cute. They cross the spectrum.
Yep.
Do you guys know about the Pika?
Isn't
the real
it called
Pikachu?
No.
Pika? Or is it a Pika?
Maybe it's a Pika.
Is it what's it? How
it's
do you spell
pika,
it?
It's a Pika, maybe. I'm going to show Tess a picture of it. It looks just like a Pikachu.
Literally just like a Pikachu?
Pretty more than you would think something was capable of. There's also, they picked the cutest picture for the Wikipedia.
I don't think that looks like a Pikachu.
Well,
come
on. No, I saw a detective Pikachu with a friend of mine who is French. She grew up in France, and she was telling me about all the different names for the Pokemon in French, because we get, you know, like American English Pokemon names, except, you know, there are some that cross over from the Japanese. Like Pikachu stays the same, I think, pretty much everywhere, but a lot of the other ones are different. And she was telling me some of them, and they were so cute because they all, like, I feel like there's somebody whose job it is to just, like, translate all these sort of subtle puns between all the Pokemon's names. And she was telling me, like, about, oh, I wish I could remember the French Jigglypuff name, if somebody could look it up, because it was so cute. It was, like, there's a French word for, like, a thing that you love that you want to hug, like your favorite childhood toy, like a teddy bear or something. So it's, like, based off of that. It's extremely, extremely cute.
I looked it up. It's Rondoudou.
Yeah.
It's French Jigglypuff.
Yeah.
Ooh, I found a list of French Pokemon names.
I mean, the English ones are, I wonder if they're always kind of like portmanteaus, you know, like Squirtle and that kind of stuff.
Charmander is called Salamèche.
Oh my God. French Pokemon fans, please give us a call. Tell us your favorite French
Pokemon. Pidgey's name is Rakul. Yeah. They all
Pikachu,
are really good.
Always
oh,
Pikachu.
But Pikachu is Pikachu.
Which is why it's easy to market a worldwide blockbuster such as Detective Pikachu, because you don't have to change the name at all.
Jigglypuff is Rondoudou and Wigglytuff is Grodoudou.
Well, we wanted to take a few night calls this week. And as always, if you have a night call, you can give us a call at 1-240-46-NIGHT. Or an email at nightcallpodcast@gmail.com. Let's start with this first one because it comes, it's the day after Mother's Day today as we're recording this. So I feel like we should read this one.
Shout out to the moms.
Shout out to Nancy, Emily's mom.
Shout out to Tess, who is a mom.
Thank you.
All right. My mom writes, good morning, ladies. I was listening to your pod on the hand that rocks the cradle and had to share a connection. It has been a long time since I watched it, but I remember the establishing shot of Peyton's apartment was the building above a favorite coffee shop in downtown Tacoma, Grounds for Coffee. But I have another connection. A friend of mine leased her house for the production, and that is where Rebecca De Mornay stayed when she was filming in Tacoma. Emily and I have both been in it for 4th of July parties because it has a great view of Puget Sound. And then she sent a photo of the former building that has Grounds for Coffee in it, or had Grounds for Coffee in it, because it is now, at least last time I was in Tacoma, a Tully's Coffee. Boo, Tully's Coffee.
Boo, Tully's Coffee.
But like, I did not recognize this in the film at all, which surprises me because this building was so iconic to me in my childhood. It was this very, to me at the time, and like, the 90s in Tacoma, it was just like the coolest, most sophisticated coffee shop. It was sort of like a mini version of the Flatiron building in New York. So it was like one of these really skinny kind of wedge buildings that sort of like where two streets kind of came to a point. And it's like four stories tall and just had like this cool lounge. It was like all windows on the bottom floor. So you could like see all the people going by in downtown Tacoma, and people like still walked around downtown Tacoma before it completely died as a downtown. So apparently her apartment was supposed to be above that, which is a pretty cool place. If it's not going to be Seattle, then that's a pretty cool place in Tacoma for an adult to live.
That made Tacoma look lovely.
It did.
Yeah, I didn't remember that. Like I said, I didn't remember that film shooting at all when I was a kid, because I think I just would have been too young. But had no idea that it was so close to home. Thanks, Mom.
Thanks, Nancy.
Emily's mom. I think we talked about our own memories of things that were shooting in neighborhoods near us.
But if you have more memories to share, please give us a call at 240-46-NIGHT. As Emily already prompted you to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to hijack our conversation for a minute because we have to spend a minute with some animals of note from the past 2 weeks, if we may. I don't know if you guys have seen the photos from this, but a Chinese live streamer named Seaside Girl Little Seven, she does kind of like, you know, mukbang type videos, and she had a live octopus that she was planning to eat, and the octopus got revenge and attached itself to her face, and she spent an entire minute trying to get it off, and she eventually succeeded. But one of our listeners shared this in the Facebook group, Night Callers, which you can certainly join, and said that she has stopped eating cephalopods because of our podcast.
Oh, good.
So I would just like to nominate this angry octopus as one of our many animal mascots.
I thought you were going to say the girl stopped eating cephalopods.
I know. I would love if this reached her.
The worst part of this story is at the end of the video, she was like, I'll eat it next time. And the response was overwhelmingly like, no, don't do it.
Yeah.
You should have learned your lesson.
I just get such like, I don't know, like vicarious PTSD is from people who are trying to eat the live octopi because like
it's not like more gross than a lot of other things involving.
It's not that it's gross. It's that it's very dangerous.
Well, it's dangerous for the person doing it, but maybe it's like in order to eat an animal, you should have to fight it to the death, you know, to deserve to eat it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I was just going to say is like I got in one of the worst fights I've ever gotten in my life over Old Boy because, you know, the scene at the beginning where he does he eats the live octopus. It's like he's just gotten out of a prison cell for 20 years or whatever. But that was done for real. And I think they did like five takes of it or something. And the actor is a Buddhist. So every time they would go up for another take, he'd have to like do a prayer to like, you know, absolve himself of taking this life because, you know, Buddhists don't eat meat and everything. And I got in like the biggest fight over the validity of Old Boy as art because of the fact that it took like, you know, probably five octopi lives to make that film.
That's horrible. That just should never have been
allowed. What side were you on?
I was on. I mean, Old Boy's great. Like,
I thought you were gonna say. I was like, you're pro Old Boy.
I'm pro Old Boy.
You can be pro Old Boy and still know that you could have had a puppet octopus.
Right. Well, that's, I mean, no, you cannot have a puppet octopus.
You could have a puppet octopus.
I think now you could do a CGI octopus, but I don't think you could have when Old Boy was made. I think it would have looked really bad.
No, you wouldn't. You can't use a CGI octopus because the whole thing is that he got out of jail and he's going to eat his favorite thing, like, which is the live octopus.
And it's like the most...
In the story, like that is true.
He's trying to feel the most alive that he possibly can.
Yeah.
And it's also just like an incredible thing to
watch. I am like a Buddhist about filmmaking only, where I think that no animals should ever be harmed in the making of anything.
How do you feel about Apocalypse Now?
Okay,
I don't budge.
Like, you eat a hamburger.
I do indeed.
So,
but I wouldn't sit down and
film
eat a live animal for a movie because
you wouldn't do
I could pretend
of a hamburger.
We would all do a mukbang of a hamburger.
I think a live animal is different. I believe that when your responsibility as an actor. That should not be tied to another life. Like five takes, five octopi, five lives. I don't think it's okay.
He could have not taken the role.
Dude, what if it had been a kitten? Okay, let's just say. Would it have been different if it were a mammal?
I feel like somebody who's like an actual practicing Buddhist who has like real religious principles around this kind of thing, but is also an artist and has decided that they can separate those two things in their life. I'm kind of like, you know what? It's your prerogative because you believe the thing that I don't believe and you've found a way through this and I don't even have that set of beliefs. So, like, I don't know. Like, in the case of eating something live in a movie as an actor.
I feel like it's like if you're eating a chicken.
Like a live chicken, Molly?
What if you had to slaughter the chicken in order to then fry it?
Like, if I had to slaughter a chicken every take in a movie and then eat more than I needed because I needed to get... That's the thing. If you're eating because you're hungry and you eat meat and you want to slaughter a chicken and eat it, I get that. But I think in the construct of making a movie, you're not eating out of hunger. You're eating as a performative thing. It can't be alive.
Here's what I love about this. Tess is coming at this from the actor's perspective of like, here's what the actor has to do. Emily's the director. She's like, the actor has to do whatever the director says. And I'm being a writer who's like, well, it's in the script. So you have to do it. It's in the script. Can't change it.
I don't know, man. I just always like animals on set has always been like a very tender point for me.
There's a lot of bad. Well, aren't people just animals, man?
Yeah.
I feel the same. I honestly feel the same way about child actors.
You
should never eat them.
You should not
never. If the child actor has already been processed, it's fine.
I'm just going to say again, Bran's going to win Game of Thrones. The child actors.
By the time this airs, we will know who won.
I was right about Splat winning Veep. Spoiler.
Okay.
So,
just spoiler.
You're on a roll now.
To be right.
Well, if you have any thoughts about animals on set, both, you know, whether they're on screen being eaten, whether they're being eaten at craft services, whether they're a human who's being eaten by our eyes when we watch them as consumers. Is that a stretch?
not a stretch.
please give us a night call at 1-240-46-NIGHT or a night email. We want your thoughts because this is obviously a very hot topic of debate and we are nowhere near resolving it.
I could go on.
I love when we stumble on something like
that.
Well,
do you guys kill bugs?
I try not to.
Yeah, but like unwillingly.
Okay. I mean,
because I only kill mosquitoes and ants that are in the house.
But mosquitoes are good.
No, mosquitoes are the number one deadliest animal, Molly. Okay.
I know.
So you only can kill... I don't kill spiders. I never kill crickets. I never kill, you know,
okay, but you're establishing
crawlies.
A hierarchy of animals and creatures.
What I'm saying is that I will not be the murderer. If I died and then someone was like, we're going to make, you know, pot roast out of Tess and someone ate it, I wouldn't be mad at the person who ate me.
Well, speaking of those theories, you guys know that I think Impossible Burger is people. And
yeah, I believe
I've
you.
I've still never had an Impossible Burger because it creeps me out too much.
Me neither, because it creeps me out too much.
The heme, the fake blood.
The heme.
No, who wants that?
Nobody wants
it. It's such a weird approach to fake meat. It's like I don't want it to be like meat. I want it to be just as satisfying as meat, but I'm not trying to replicate the experience. Like,
do you know what? You know what ruined it for me is when a reviewer said that the consistency was cat food like. I was like, goodbye, and I'm out. Never gonna try that ever in my life.
I think it's people. I think it's people meat they grew in a lab, and then when it's fully caught on, they're gonna be like, guess what? It's people meat. Everybody likes it already.
Wouldn't that be shocking? Because they were like, and it's not the one called Soylent.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Soylent
was a red herring. They're like, let's do this
Soylent's
first.
A red herring. Although I will say, I wish there was something like Soylent that tasted good. I drink a lot.
I don't. You don't like food?
I like protein smoothies. Sometimes I like don't want to eat for the first part of the day. I don't want
to. You don't have to.
I love a juice.
But you need something.
I love a juice.
Almond milk or whatever. Yeah, juice. I love juice. You know when everyone came down on juice? Yeah, exactly.
Why? Because it's all sugar?
Yeah, but it's great.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Delicious.
I'm like, I don't really have an issue with juice. I have an issue with processed sugar, but like I will not deny myself juice. It seems
a nice mellow green juice with like a little bit of like lemon in it is very nice.
I can't believe this is where we all agree. We're such basics
about juice.
We're like, guys,
I make my own juice.
Good? A kale juice, a little bit of kale.
I like a straight up orange juice with ginger.
Oh, that's good.
That's a really good juice.
Talking about juice.
Talking about juice. Hey, let's take a night call, you guys. Okay, so we have a night call from Mackenzie. Hello, night call team. I have recently come upon a Craigslist post for a harpsichord that is very possibly built by Dr. Kevorkian. Is it possible to solve this mystery or the further moral mystery of whether building Baroque instruments is okay? Thank you. Also, in closing screen grabs in case the listing is removed, which we will put in our show notes. Okay, so this harpsichord was listed for $650. It's for sale in Echo Park. It's called the Zuckerman Harpsichord. So it's a long
posting.
Yeah,
I mean, the posting is, we should probably read a part of it, but like we'll link to it and hopefully it's still up, or we'll just do a screen grab of it if it goes down for any reason. I love how there's a long intro where it just talks about, like, it's a really nice instrument, like a very nice 60s harpsichord. Like, think pet...
Hard sell in the preamble
here. Yeah, like pet sounds, anyone?
Hard sell.
Like,
yeah.
So it says, according to the guy who sold me this harpsichord, Karen Kammerer was a nurse who worked at the same hospital that Dr. Kevorkian practiced at in Eugene, Oregon. If you know about Dr. Kevorkian or Dr. Death, you may know that he led a highly controversial practice of assisted suicide. There were a few states where assisted suicide was legal, two of which were in the Pacific Northwest, Washington and Oregon. This Michigan-born doctor naturally gravitated to these states because this is where he could practice. A lot of articles have been written on Dr. Kevorkian, and a few of them mention him as being an amateur musician and composer, that he played the flute, organ, piano, and harpsichord. Even fewer of these articles mention that he also built his own harpsichords. Sources for this information can be found at the bottom of this ad. The ad itself, the Craigslist itself, has like a sources cited section. So
yes.
Anyway, allegedly after Karen Kammerer, Nate Kincaid, retired as a nurse from this hospital, she started teaching classical piano and wrote for the local newspaper where she mostly covered music events. She was married to a music professor, Edward Kammerer, who taught at the University of Oregon. The guy who sold me this harpsichord believed that Dr. Death built a harpsichord for Kammerer while they worked together at the hospital in Eugene, Oregon. This makes sense, as Dr. Kevorkian was a consummate bachelor who not only was highly interested in music, but could also build harpsichords. So, like, it's like,
sure,
okay.
Of course.
I'm more worried about the person selling this harpsichord than the harpsichord itself.
I mean, it seems like it checks out. It feels like it's just like a bit of ephemera. Like, it doesn't feel like a cursed object like other things that we've discussed on this podcast.
No, because Dr. Kevorkian is cool.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're pro Dr. Kevorkian.
Definitely pro. I can speak for, yeah, maybe not all of us are. I am.
Yeah, we're cool. All pro.
Do pro? It. Yeah. Okay, good. My question, though, is why did this person buy this harpsichord and then not fix up the harpsichord and is now trying to,
up?
Like,
or, huh? I thought it was in good condition.
No, because at the end it says, this old gal needs some TLC. All strings are present, but a bunch of the pluckers on the plectrums.
Pluckers
on the plectrums need some work. The leather pluckers that have problems appear to be a bit limp. This is like a poetic.
There's so few people who are probably like harpsichord technicians that you could just make up all the words about a harpsichord. Like, oh yeah, the pluckers are a little bit rusty.
So the seller says, I bought this harpsichord with the intention of doing it myself, meaning fixing it up, but just never got around to it, even though it includes a manual. Guys, I'm going to say that I think this harpsichord is a haunted harpsichord. I don't know if it belonged to Dr. Kevorkian or if this harpsichord just came from someone who's like a bad person. I don't know. Maybe this person wants to sell a harpsichord for almost $700. They're staring at it. They're like, who would buy? Oh, you know what? It needs a good backstory.
Have you ever, like, bought something at a yard sale and been like, ooh, a project, and then never touched it again? Like, I that checks out to me.
Not a harpsichord. A sofa.
I can see somebody being like, you have to buy this harpsichord that Dr. Kevorkian built. It's a one-time only deal. And you're like, okay, fine, I'll take it. And then
you're like,
you
no.
forget about it. Or it's just, like, too much work.
You realize
it's
you need some tool that you don't have or something, and then it just keeps getting put off. I mean, this is very plausible to
or
me.
Like, you don't know how to play the harpsichord, but you were envisioning a world where you
right,
would
yeah,
learn.
Better life
that
for yourself.
That feels like a very
yeah.
Echo Park thing to do. Like, I'm going to start a band that has a harpsichord in it.
The harpsichord band.
If you put up an ad in Echo Park for Dr. Kevorkian's harpsichord, it would sell for $700 like hotcakes.
I don't know. So you think, but it's $650, and that I don't know.
Well, how much does a harpsichord cost? It's a piece of machinery.
That's a Lucille Bluth question.
Oh, I was just going to say that if the person wanted to sell the harpsichord, they could probably just, like, take a nice blanket down to the Walgreens parking lot and sit with the harpsichord out there.
It would go in a day
in
Los Angeles. Beechwood Canyon, sell that harpsichord.
You think someone would buy a harpsichord for $650 in poor condition?
Yes, if they knew it was built by Dr. Kevorkian.
See, I think that works against the harpsichord.
Why?
I do.
Hollywood Boulevard, sell it in 10 minutes.
All right. Well, let's keep tabs. If possible, keep your eye out for future postings about this harpsichord. If not, we'll have to assume it's sold. But I'm curious. I'm pretty skeptical, y'all.
Also, the fact that Dr. Kevorkian was a harpsichord enthusiast on the side just makes me like him more.
So industrious. a multi-talent.
So, guys, we had another topic that we wanted to talk about that has turned into like a... It's somehow related to conspiracy theories, but it was an interesting interesting topic on its own.
This is as close as we're going to get to a QAnon chat on this podcast. Sorry, everybody who's expecting us to go in the QAnon direction.
Well, we're anti-QAnon, but
no, we're clearly anti-QAnon.
We like to talk about conspiracy theories from an angle of like some of these things are real, or point to other, or some things that are real don't get talked about that should be talked about more.
Well, let's just start with the facts before the conspiracy element got introduced. Recently, more than 1,000 guns were found at a Holmby Hills residence. LAPD and the ATF came and found like gun manufacturing equipment, like 1,000 guns,
huge amount, like a huge cache,
huge, crazy
of arms. I like that in the, I think it is the KTLA article where there was like a rabbi who worked in the neighborhood or something. He's like, I grew up in Brooklyn and even I've never seen anything like this, like implying that there's just tons of gun caches everywhere in Brooklyn.
I think there might be more gun caches around than we want to think about.
Yeah.
I cannot believe how low the bail was for the
guy. Oh my God. The bail was $50,000. So he's out now on bail. This guy's name is Gerard Sands, I think. And so he's a renter in this house that is owned by a woman named Cynthia Beck, who was the former mistress of Gordon Getty, who is J. Paul Getty's son and worth like $2 billion. So she was a mistress of Getty's, has three of his children. She owns all of these properties all over Los Angeles, and many of them are abandoned and dilapidated. Like, she has one in Malibu that shares a driveway with John McEnroe, and it's on half an acre in Malibu, and it's just totally abandoned. She has one in Echo Park that's like an abandoned
Necol compound in Malibu.
I know. Cynthia Beck, call us up.
Donate to our Patreon so we can buy this compound.
But she, apparently she's a recluse and she now is like maybe somewhere in Europe, but she is, it seems to be like a friend of the guy who was arrested and was making these guns. So we don't know too much information.
Maybe a former paramour.
Maybe. We don't know.
There was a secondary location in Chinatown that also got raided.
Yes.
That was connected to the same guy?
Yeah.
Oh my
God. Yeah. Same guy. He had two huge weapons caches.
So this, Molly was saying at some point before we started recording that this has now been tied to like conspiracy theories about the deep state among like Democratic donors in California.
Right.
Well.
So basically,
let's just say a lot of prominent, powerful people do have like shadowy stuff going on.
Yeah.
Such as it's like the tech billionaires are upfront about it. That they have weird panic room scenarios planned out.
And I think that anybody who has the resources to create a panic room probably has resources to do the things to amass the sorts of things that would make other people want to have panic rooms, you know? Like, you have your defense and you have your offense. Like, I don't know. Like, it feels like there's always all this sort of general talk and anxiety right now about like, oh man, like what if it just becomes a civil war? But I feel like the like real crazy people who have a ton of money are already like totally prepared for that already. It does not strike me as surprising at all.
Right, because they know that the poor people should revolt against
them.
So they're totally prepared for the possibility that it could happen. They got the Les Mis set up.
It does look like some Les Mis shit. Like all those photos of just like piled, they're like rifles.
They were all kinds of guns. It was quite alarming. We were arguing about the exact geography of where this house was located. It was, I believe, on Beverly Glen, which goes all the way, you know, through Sherman Oaks in the valley, and then I believe like even south of Wilshire. So it cuts like a very large.
It's like
the, path.
It goes through like the UCLA neighborhood, because I used to walk up Beverly Glen when I used to. Park.
Yeah, my mom said that she drives past this house every day on her commute to work, and that she was like, I could not believe right there. It's like a pretty trafficked location.
It is, yeah.
It's not in the middle of nowhere like you would assume
a
gun cache panic room thing would be. It's right in the cut.
I think they found it because of an anonymous tip, and it's interesting too because it sounds as though this was all kind of like cloaked in secrecy for most of the neighbors, and you wonder how somebody figured out what was going on. I think that the tip, and I might be wrong about this, but I believe that the tip said that there was, you know, that guns were being manufactured and sold, which is the technicality that allowed them to go in there, because I think you are allowed to have a gigantic cache of guns. You're just not allowed to manufacture and sell them.
That's what the worst part was, the statement. They were like, you can have as many guns as you want. You just need a license. They were like, you can have literally thousands of guns, and that's perfectly
better
legal.
Better have a permit and a license. But we were talking about how this sort of feels, the whole continuing Brittany gate as well, and all these stories that kind of feel like they're at least fueled and at least magnified in the public imagination by sites like Crazy Days and Nights, which we are all regular readers of, I believe, but it's also gone totally in the conspiracy theory direction recently.
Well, the commenters went really hard in the QAnon direction, and some of the Crazy Days and Nights lines go really hard in the QAnon direction, but what was crazy was this Getty related gun cache story did imply, like, oh, maybe there's some truth to the idea that there are like shadowy cabals of rich dynasties that can do stuff above the law. There's
can
a lot of
like,
truth
buy
to that
and equip them and everything. Like,
yeah, and it would be naive to think that people aren't doing that, especially in anticipation of like climate change.
So you just like shoot the fires and the until they go away. It's a really, really strong strategy.
The movie The Day After Tomorrow, Day After Tomorrow taught me you outrun weather.
Yeah, you got to outrun the weather.
You outrun extreme
weather.
You
can do it. I was kind of very skeptical of the Free Britney campaign, thinking that it was largely based on conspiracy.
We were skeptical because it seemed like people were overreaching their sort of citizen duties as fans into like, we must protect Britney because she is not being protected by her family. Turned out that was true.
Yeah, Britney has now joined. Well, you probably know because now it's a week old and everyone's eyes have been on Britney today. But yeah, Britney has joined the Free Britney campaign and wants her conservatorship to end. I've always thought this was like a very enduringly interesting kind of situation with the conservatorship. So little information has come out. And usually in situations like these, you'll have like a lot of leaked information that will kind of point you to what's actually happening. And maybe out of respect for her privacy, like maybe for good reasons, this has been protected. But it's super, it's taken some very
bizarre
turns.
Wait, so what's the latest
turns?
On it? Because last I knew she had, you know, posted the video saying that my family and I are going through a tough time right now. We respect your privacy. Like,
Well, today it was announced or leaked to TMZ that she's going to get the conservatorship repealed and that she was put in the mental hospital against her will
and what
by her
was,
dad.
But what, like, precipitated that? Why did she get put in the, like...
Because...
Reportedly... Her medication wasn't working, and so she started kind of getting out of control, and her dad put her...
But it's also she's so tightly controlled that one of the things that they were like, she's out of control, she was driving by herself to get fast food.
Right, she's not supposed to, she's not allowed
supposed
to drive.
She's like a child. Yeah. It's like they treat her like a child. She can't do anything that an adult can do, and if she doesn't, like something an adult can do by themselves, they're like, that's violating the conservatorship. Yeah. Which is super fucked up, especially for somebody who was a pageant child and child star and then teen star.
I hesitate to armchair diagnose anything going on with her. Like, I feel like she probably does have some serious issues. And like, while I wouldn't say like, oh, I definitely know that a conservatorship is the right thing for her, I think like people saying like she should be able to live a life just like all the rest of us is like a little bit naive. Like, we don't know what her situation is because it is
I read there was an amazing ONTD deep dive on her parents. ONTD original. Oh, no, they didn't. One is not always great. They also have some QAnon and like TERFs in the comments there even. Mm-hmm. It's not perfect. But some of the original journalism, including their piece about Britney's dad, was very interesting. You know, they have a history, not to armchair diagnose, but Britney's grandmother killed herself. Mm-hmm. And the whole family was like traumatized by it. Like, she was very much put in the position of being the breadwinner from like a childhood age, which is traumatic and abusive, I would say, to do to kids.
100%.
You know, to be like, you're the moneymaker. Like, her parents are not the people who should be in charge at this point, or like at least not her dad. I don't think her family has her best interests at heart necessarily, again, or at least her dad in the conservatorship. And that's what became clear. Like, if, I don't know, I feel like she should be allowed to decide whether she wants to be committed or not.
Yeah. I think it's trickier than it appears, but what's interesting is that, you know, after Brittany's Graham, the podcast started kind of bringing some of these things to light, a lot of people were pretty defensive and saying, you know, that by prying into her private life, they were doing her a real disservice. And I sided with those people. I was like, how intrusive, you know, especially if she's having a tough time, if she's struggling with mental health issues, it seems really unfair to put a spotlight on her. But now seems clear is that Brittany's Graham, I believe, was kind of reading into these Instagram posts that she was posting. And one of them was like a hole in a brick. And the caption was, "There's always a way out." And they were like, "Look, she's trying to say that she's trapped in this conservatorship," which seems totally bonkers
to infer that. Because she posts so much inspirational content. Right. And you could just read anything you want.
But like, isn't her Instagram totally run by like other people, though, at this point, too?
No, I don't think so.
Instagram went dark after she went, after she was like placed in the mental institution. So it seems as though it actually is partially run by her.
And it's very corny, which makes it seem like it's genuinely hers, you know?
No shade.
But she posts like some deep fried memes and stuff sometimes where it's like a screenshot of a screenshot where you're like, that feels real.
Yeah.
That feels like Brittany would do that. And she does those fashion shows at home. No, I mean, she's such an interesting person.
Yeah.
It seems to me personally that when she signed another Vegas contract, like something happened where she either didn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
The part that's conspiratorial is that they argued that her dad is not sick, that he was like faking his illness or being sick in order to have an excuse of like, that's why Brittany's taking time off. When it was really that she had mental health problems, you know, or just needed to take time off for mental health. And the same thing was like, then she had another breakdown because her dad is sick.
Right.
And people were like, is her dad sick? If he's sick, why is he in charge? If he might die soon. Just a lot of things seemed kind of out of whack.
Right.
I think a lot of things that seem complicated, you're like, oh, it's not actually complicated. It's just structured in a way where you're like, it doesn't make any sense.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. The entire conversation around this like creeped me out so much that I didn't really ever go too deep on the initial Free Britney thing, just because I did think that it seemed super presumptuous.
Ditto.
And kind of like a weird like projection-y type thing that I didn't like, that all these fans, all the stan culture stuff that I just like couldn't
stan
really get
culture.
With. But I mean, I don't know. This all just happened today, so yeah, who knows what'll.
Yeah, I just feel like there's a lot of Perfect Blue stuff happening in pop culture right now.
I just watched Perfect Blue again this week. Shout out to the good people at G Kids who sent me a Blu-ray of it.
It's so good.
It's so good.
Such a great movie.
I love it.
But yeah, Ariana Grande also like put out a statement about her mental health, just being like, I should be happy because I just headlined Coachella and I'm like the saddest I've ever been in my life. And that made me like her again for a minute because I was like, aw. Like,
well, I can't wait till she feels lit inside. I don't know.
I just feel like being a pop star of that magnitude, being a star of that magnitude, and especially as a young woman, it would ruin your life.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It would destroy your life and alienate you from yourself so much. Mm-hmm. And that it must be such a unique mental health situation. It's like, how could you even treat that? The only people who understand this are like Britney and like Marilyn Monroe.
Well, it's like being like, shot into space. Right. Like the only people who can understand you are other people who have been to space. I think at a certain point, you're just like, you don't know.
Whoa,
you don't know
like
what
that.
It's like to like see the earth from up here. Like, yeah.
Wow. Can I take a Momo minute to condemn Jeff Bezos'
space condos?
Oh, Jesus
Christ. Yeah.
Oh, please condemn them hard.
Night call rules. No.
Yeah.
space condos. But however, if all the rich people, if all the super rich billionaires
this is what
want to
I
go
was
to
saying,
space
yes.
to the space condos,
like,
they're
like,
going to
we
space
won't
madness.
Stop them. I love the idea of being like, oh my God, this is such a good idea, Jeff. Hey, yeah, we're right behind you. We'll be moving into our space condos next week. But you go on ahead. You go on ahead. And then just like letting him be up there by himself and go crazy.
You guys go first. And you can just make and manufacture all the guns you want in your
And you'll have so
space
many
mansions.
Mozarts and Einsteins. Like,
and Dr. Kevorkian's harpsichord, you can bring it with you. It'll be a nice relic.
And we will just tend to the dying planet and nurse it back to
without
health,
your interference. You like, in space. You know, you can.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, my God. No, the whole thing about like, oh, if we have a trillion people in space, that means 1,000 more Einsteins and Mozarts. I was just like, are you?
I couldn't even handle it because it was so. But I'm just like, it makes me angry at everyone because it makes me angry at anyone who ever enabled him to like be in this position. I was just thinking today, I was like, in the universe where like Alta Vista is the predominant search engine, like none of this happened.
I'm like, oh, nice. Yeah. If we could only go back.
They're so stupid. They should be exposed. That's the whole thing about the Elizabeth Holmes documentary is you're like, expose her as a fraud, but like expose them all as frauds. They're all just like fake intel, like TED Talks in a vest being like, none of the people who have all the money know any, like are doing what they should with it.
Yeah.
And that is why people are having gun caches in the hills, because they know we're going to all figure that out. And the price is wrong.
Guys,
the jury's out.
This is too depressing. I think we need to pivot to one last night call and to feel lit inside again.
I want to feel lit inside like I do every time I hear the word pivot, and it triggers me to shudder uncontrollably.
We will be pivoting forever.
We've got a night call from Austin. Hey, Night Call. I'm driving at the moment, so I must keep it brief, but does Werewolves of London by Warren Zevon count as a cryptid song? If so, that's probably in the running for the most famous cryptid in popular music, no? Anyway, thank you. Austin from Milwaukee.
Austin from Milwaukee, I believe you're right. Werewolves of London is totally a cryptid song.
Is there a ranking that we can find where we can like look at songs by like what they talk about and then which one is the most popular so we can decide definitively what the most popular werewolf songs, because I feel like there's a lot of werewolf songs. Maybe there are more werewolf songs than any other.
Werewolves are mentioned in Personality Crisis. You're a prima ballerina on a summer afternoon or whatever.
Other people, I don't know what you're talking about. What are the other werewolf songs?
I don't know. Wolf Like Me by TV on the Radio. There's a really
About being a real wolf.
It's about like wolves.
That's not about being a werewolf.
Is it not?
It really is. It's like it's about like when the moon is whatever. I forget the lyrics of that song. But there's also a really amazing. There's a Mexican band called La Union that has like the song that I love. That's about werewolves. Also called, I think it's called like Lobo Hombre in Paris. He's like the Wolfman in Paris.
Where does the MASH fit into this?
The Monster Mash. That's just got all of them.
Are those cryptids, though? Are they like technically creatures?
Well, the mummy,
or
I believe.
It's like Haunted House
mummies
of
are
Rock.
Actual people that have been mummified.
Right. Mummies are not cryptids.
Yeah.
Frankenstein, also not a cryptid.
No, I think you need, yeah, I mean, there might, in the Monster Mash, there might be a werewolf element.
I would like to know.
I don't know. I
can't think. I'm hard pressed to think of something.
Purple People Eater is one.
Okay, Purple People Eater.
Yeah. Personality Crisis mentions the werewolf howling at the moon. I think that counts.
The werewolf bar mitzvah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
There's not that many.
I still think that like the
She-Wolf
real...
by Shakira.
Ooh.
I Was a Teenage Werewolf by The Cramps. None of these are more famous than Werewolves of London.
No, Werewolves of London is such a good song.
Producer Rachel is informing us there's a Blue Oyster Cult song about Godzilla.
That's a great song about Godzilla. I love that song. You will be shocked to know there are two Rob Zombie songs about werewolves.
No.
That's great.
Both from 2010, Werewolf Women of the SS and Werewolf Baby!
Baby. What about, are there swamp creature songs? There's a mountain goat song, How to Embrace a Swamp Creature.
All right, I found a list. Loch Ness by Judas Priest.
Nice.
Hellhound on My Trail by Robert Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Monster Mash.
I'm curious about how the Monster Mash shakes out here.
He was working in the lab late one night.
Monsters are not necessarily cryptids, I'm just saying.
What defines a cryptid? The dictionary definition of cryptid is...
I think it's like an unproven species. Like it's a species that has been theorized but not proven to exist, right?
Oh, okay.
But it's not a human, correct? It cannot be a human. Yeah.
A mummy is definitely not a cryptid.
So a mummy can't
be. A werewolf?
Okay.
No. I think a werewolf is debatable. Okay. I think when it's in werewolf form, maybe. But I think like overall, the phenomenon of a werewolf is not a cryptid.
The zombies are having fun.
Zombies are not cryptids.
The party had just begun.
Okay.
The guests included Wolfman.
Okay.
Dracula and his son.
Well, the Wolfman is a different werewolf. Than...
Excuse me? How? He's the number one okay, werewolf never mind, in the then. Gang.
I still think the best cryptid is the Squonk.
Yeah.
This when Steely Dan busts out a Squonk because Squonks can't stop crying and they die because they just can't stop crying. I think that that is like still the best cryptid in a song. Werewolves of London is a very good song as well. It's a good cryptid.
Yeah, we're going to have a night call playlist coming out soon. So get in all your requests for cryptid jams before Molly cuts that mix and they might make it.
And if you would like access to that mix, why don't you go ahead and subscribe to our Patreon, which is patreon.com/nightcall. We have different tiers and rewards, but you will get access to our show notes, a monthly newsletter, mixtapes, and more.
$3 a month will give you the monthly newsletter and mixtape. So 2 in 1 plus show notes, extra nightcall content all month long.
And if we hit our goal of $2,000 a month, then we will do a live call-in show, which we're really excited to do because we've been wanting to do that for a long time. Maybe we'll even do it one day anyway. But you should still subscribe to our Patreon. And if you're enjoying the show, would you please consider rating, reviewing, and subscribing and following us on social media, Night Call Podcast on Facebook and Instagram, Night Call Pod on Twitter.
And we'll see you all next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And if you haven't watched it yet, just going to plug it again. Watch the little infomercial we made for the Night Call Patreon.
Oh, yeah.
A joint collaboration between these three heads.
Bye.
Yay. Hey.